My name's Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you for having me here and letting me be part of your celebration tonight. I was waiting for you to do a whole bunch more of the readings, so I left Atlanta a week ago tomorrow. This is my third AA event, all the way from Portland down to Valdosta, Portland, Oregon, down to Valdosta. So if I doze off at the stand here, somebody just kind of nudge me and remind me where I was. But it's a pleasure to be here with you. And for those of you who are new to AA that I just saw, welcome. I don't know about you. I didn't want to be here. As a matter of fact, I'd have cut an arm off to avoid this thing if I'd have had my druthers. And it's kind of a poor choice of words, but I often say I did not fly in here on the wings of victory. I would have missed it all, though. I really would have missed it all if I could have done it my way. I get to come in here tonight and spend some time with you and be sober. Saw one of my native brothers, James, that I haven't seen for a while. Another light-eyed Indian guy. And I thought, I'm not too sure, but I think if James and I were both drinking tonight, you guys would be well advised to get your wagons in a circle. I think two of us would be enough. My sobriety date is March the 7th of 1990. I had no idea that's what it was going to be when I walked into a place in Fargo, North Dakota called a Speakeasy Restaurant Lounge. I had no idea that those were going to be my last series of drinks, at least up to this point. I'm going to talk about 3 days, March 7th, 8th, and 9th, that roll around every year. You know, it's been a while since the 1990 dates and the events of that moment. But I'm grateful that the intensity with which I remember those 3 days has not seemed to fade a whole lot. I hope they never do. I mean, I can look at my watch on any of those days and I know exactly where I was at that moment in time, what was taking place. And I hope it stays that way because I don't ever want to go back and repeat that. On March the 8th, early in the morning, an event took place that rocked the nation. You know, my timing is perfect as far as slow news days are concerned. And anyway, an event took place that had not ever reached the public's attention at that moment in time, and that was three airline pilots were arrested for having flown from Fargo, North Dakota to the Twin Cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. I was the captain of that crew. That was a first I didn't want. We were detained for about 12 hours that day, in a day that was very surreal. I couldn't believe that what was happening was actually happening, because that wasn't supposed to happen to me. That wasn't the way I conducted my life up to that point, I didn't think. Certainly wasn't the way that I was supposed to watch it end. Typically, when we come to the podium, very seldom do we hear anything about our chosen career field or profession or whatever our job may be, because it hasn't got anything to do with really with the recovery aspect of it. And I talk about it only because it was a central core part of that story and it was the thing that generated all the media attention. And I like to always make clear to you that I'm not an airline pilot who is an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic who got to be an airline pilot through a lot of good breaks and circumstances. So the other part of that is, you know, if I'd been anything else but an airline pilot, none of this, I probably wouldn't be here tonight. The, you know, if I'd been a doctor, an attorney, a construction worker, plumber, electrician, or anything other than what I was, it wouldn't have been newsworthy. Nor would it have qualified me for a federal felony conviction and a prison term. So that's why I talk about it, is that it was one of the factors that made it what it was. I'm a pretty hardcore believer that this fellowship doesn't have any stars or celebrities or people that are elevated in any way, shape, or form, regardless of what they do, who they are, whether they were living under a bridge a few weeks ago or they own the finest home in Powder Springs. Just doesn't make any difference. I think the only thing that ever comes to us, the highest level of anything we ever achieve here in this fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous, is a condition called sobriety. And that's the great equalizer. That's the thing that allows me to rub elbows with you and with people that, you know, it says we would not normally mix. I think that's got to be the most massive understatement in the entire big book. Because I've gotten to know and be with people that whose paths I would never have crossed otherwise. And I'm so grateful for that. And I'm blessed because of it. So, you know, I refuse to buy into this idea that we have elevated people or special people or celebrities in AA, and that's been my position for a long time, and until I get an email saying that we just broke ground on the AA Hall of Fame, I will continue. I'm going to stay with that. The 3 days that unwound, and you know, I can tell you that when I walked off the airplane that morning, early in March the 8th, after landing at Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, when I saw two airport policemen and I saw FAA officials and I saw Northwest Airlines people, and I could keep my airline anonymous if I wish to, and I don't do it for a reason that I hope becomes obvious. The instant, overwhelming, totally, absolutely penetrating feeling I had was one of shame. I mean, it was immediate. Shame and disgrace. I used to kind of stumble around at the podium trying to find the words that I thought would convey to you exactly what I meant by that. And the big book says it very, very shortly, succinctly, and in a way that I'll never be able to overdo, and that is when it talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Boy, it was all that and more. And what happened was in the days that unwound ahead of me, that was just going to expand exponentially. It was going to get so much worse than I thought it was possible to do. As I look back on it, I thought, why was that such a devastating thing for me? And I think part of it was that I had been the guy in my family as I raised three children and sent them out into the world. I was the guy that said things to them throughout the entire course of their growing up, like duty, honor, country, character, honesty, integrity, do the right thing. And in the aftermath of what I had done and what became so publicized and the consequences and the fallout that occurred, it made all the things that I'd ever tried to espouse or tell my kids seem very hollow and meaningless and without merit. And I had a great deal of difficulty with that. Northwest Airlines at that time was the only major carrier that did not have a program for alcoholic pilots. I'm not the only alcoholic pilot. There have been over 4,000 of us who have graced the cockpits of the airliners. One of the doctors who's worked in the field for 30 years says, you know, when I get on the airplane, if I glance up there and I see somebody I recognize, I breathe a sigh of relief. And if I don't, I sit back there and wonder. They're the best pilots I've ever seen, the recovering guys that I know. But Northwest had chosen not to go along with that program. We have an astounding recovery rate, success rate, 92-95% overall, bounces around a little bit, not because they're pilots, but because it's a long-term process. 3-year monitoring, peer monitoring, doctors, accountability, management people, meetings all the time, people watching. That's why it's successful. And what I've seen over time is that many of them who will dot the I's and cross the T's and comply at some point in time during that monitoring pick up. And they say, you know what? They were right all along. I belong here. And that's what I usually see. Some don't make it, obviously. And so they don't fly again, nor should they. But Northwest was the only one that didn't have, you know, every 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, a pilot in Northwest get in trouble with drinking, and it would come to the company's attention. And the outcome was always swift and severe. They were terminated. They never came back. The rest of us knew their names. We knew the incidents. I knew the sketchy details of what had happened. We had our own little personal halls of shame. And among the millions of thoughts that I had that day is, that's where my name is going to go. That wasn't what I was aiming for. I'm going to talk about two parents who died from this disease, but I never go to the podium without thanking my parents, because they weren't drunk all the time, and before this disease killed them and destroyed the family, and before the horrifically bad things happened inside the family, they gave me some good things. And so I owe them. Not an alcoholic, because my parents were. And so I always acknowledge that my parents gave me some really, really good genes and some good qualities, and I'm indebted to them for that. They gave me work ethic that is very strong, because I watched them before the booze killed them. And they had told me, always do your best. Always leave every effort and endeavor, no matter how petty, no matter how small, nor how big. Do it to the best of your ability and leave it in a bright, shiny way. And so whether I was putting on a Marine Corps uniform, an airline uniform, representing my heritage, my profession, my airline, that's what I strove to do, until the alcoholism took that away from me. And in one fell swoop, I destroyed and tarnished and shamed and disgraced everything that had any value in my life. And it happened very quickly. And it was complete. I didn't miss anything. So I knew what was going to happen. I knew some of what was going to happen. It was a surreal day that day for 12 hours. There were times when I looked around and I felt I was out of body. I was watching this happen to somebody else. And then there were other times I'd look around, see what was going on, and I almost get physically ill, just almost throw up. We were finally released. I'd given a sworn statement. We'd been to two facilities and given blood. It was at one of those facilities, the second one, where a reporter saw three uniformed pilots escorted by two uniformed cops and thought there might be a story. You know, I knew this thing was going to sweep Northwest Airlines like wildfire, just like it always did. I had no idea that it was going to go all over the world, but it did. I got back to a commuter apartment that night and tried to call home. I'd forgotten that due to the trauma and all of the events, I'd forgotten that I was supposed to be home that night. And my wife sat out here at the Atlanta airport for 4 hours and waited on me, and was still gone when my phone call came in and I heard my voice on the answering machine, and I didn't know how to say what I needed to say. And all I could say was, there's been a disaster. I think I've lost my job. I'll be home on the first flight in the morning. I do not know why she did not return that call, having picked up a message like that, but she didn't. And I considered that a gift and a blessing later on, because I was so sick I just couldn't talk about it. I got home the next morning early. I knew it was the last time I would ever wear a uniform. This was the last time I'd ever put that on. I hurried out of the airport. I didn't want anybody to see me or speak to me. And Barbara was parked out at the front. I've never told a story of what I didn't say. I had to climb over, felt like I had to climb over the curb to get in the car with her. And I couldn't look at her, and she and I had been married a long time. I could not look at my wife. She pulled away from the curb, and all I could say was, honey, I'm so sorry. She has a very soft South Texas voice, and she said, in that soft manner she has, who better than I can possibly understand how you might feel right now? And we drove home in silence. Again, another gift. She had every right to say, you've been there 22 years and you just lost one of the best careers in the country, because you were drinking and you knew what Northwest was like and you knew the consequences, and you why did you stay? She never said any of that. We got home and she went to work, and I walked in the house. I did not want to be in my skin, and within moments I went to the phone and I called a PhD doctor who was the only person I knew to call, and he will get involved in the story a little bit down the road, his family therapist. The thing about this moment and this time and this experience was, I was done. It was over for me. I was through. So I told him what had happened. He said, I want you to come straight in here. So I drove over, and it was as though this had just happened. I can see the office just like it was 5 minutes ago. And I walked in there and I told him again what had happened, and he looked at me and said, God, Lyle, he said, this is horrible. He said, it's absolutely horrible. This is now Friday, March the 9th. I was going to hear two statements that day that I simply could not mentally process, fathom, figure out, or understand why, how they could be said. And when I heard the first one then, because he turned and he looked at me and he said, "But maybe this is what had to happen." I had no idea why he would say that to me. He left and came back and he said, "I've just talked to a very prominent doctor here in Atlanta." He said he wants to see you at 6 o'clock tonight. Now, even in spite of the shredded mental and emotional condition I was in, I picked up on that. I knew that doctors typically did not see patients at 6 o'clock on Friday afternoons. And I knew that that conveyed a certain sense of urgency. Later, he told me, he said, "Based on your condition and your appearance," he said, "I was afraid you were going to be a suicide. And I needed to get you in there to see him." Barbara and I drove across Atlanta, following this detailed set of instructions. I walked in that man's office, and Barbara waited outside. And I hadn't had anything to eat or drink for 2 days. But that entire meeting with that doctor is just like an alcoholic blackout. I have no memory, really, of what took place in that meeting. I know I was there. I have no idea how long I was there. I do know that when he asked me a question, I gave him the answer as best I could. And at some point, wherever it was, he looked at me and said, "Law, you're an alcoholic, and you need to get into treatment tonight." And I didn't recoil at that, which was another strange thing, because I've hated alcoholics my entire life. I saw the two parents. I saw what happened. I saw what it did in the Native community. I'd been around cities all over this country, and I'd seen them in the doorways, in the alleys, in the park benches. I knew what alcoholics were, I thought. Had a very thin, narrow picture of what an alcoholic was, and a very thin profile, and I didn't fit that. I think in some way that I'll never really understand, in the 24 hours since the arrest, in a way that came to me probably subconsciously, I was not aware of it, I knew what I was, because I had just lost a lifetime of a hard scrabble climb to the top and a lot of achievement, because when I go into a bar, I didn't intend to stay, but I don't seem to quit once I start drinking. Now, I need to tell you, I'm not going to go through a big, long drinking dialogue here. I don't have time. I'm going to really be pushed to do this. I've got a timer up here to make sure we're out of here by 10 o'clock. And I just don't have time for a lot of stuff. You're not going to hear 70% of the story. You may think you did or feel like you did, but you're not going to hear 70% of it. So I'm not going to go through a long, big, long drinking thing here. I'll tell you, when I got into treatment and they started talking about the disease, which I think is considerably different than just the behavior that I witnessed, every single thing that they came up with fit me. Nobody was holding me down trying to pour this in my ear. I was sitting, I was quiet, I was watching, I was listening, and every symptom that they cited was one that I had. Every one of them. And nobody had to know that but me. One of them is, of course, I had reached that point where when I start to drink, I just don't quit. It's not my intention. My intention was not to go into the speakeasy that night and destroy a career and make the headlines, the late night comics routines, and watch everything I had disappear. That wasn't my intention. But it's what happens when I drink. I had two DWIs. They were separated by about 5 or 6 years. I was convinced both of those were just coincidental. Didn't belong to me. It was just bad moment in time. I mean, one of my Indian buddies that I really like talks about his DWIs, and he said he was in court for the sixth time before he learned that DWI did not stand for drinking with Indians. See, one of the things I like about being sober is our laughter. I mean, we laugh about stuff most people would never find funny. But when we do it, it's whole and it's healthy and it's healing, because we've moved into that area of life and recovery, and we can do those things. And I think it's one of the best things that we have is our laughter. I had the two DWIs, and that was pretty much it. The other thing you won't hear me say is that I never fit in. That's a common theme. I hear a lot of stories, and it's true for the people who come up and tell you that. It's not true for me. Nor is it going to be true that I'll tell you that I took that first drink and boy did I find what I was looking for. The magic happened. Not true for me either. I heard another guy talk about that the other day, and I went up to him. I said, "You're one of the few guys who talks about the progression in the same terms that I do. It took me a while to get there." You know, eventually I'll get there. We progress at different rates. Some of us quick, some of us slow. And I was one of those slower ones. And one of the reasons I think it took a while to pull me out of the crowd is because I was always in a hard drinking environment. I'll talk about that a little bit. I was a Marine. I was supposed to be able to drink hard. Later, I was a fighter pilot. Supposed to be able to drink hard. I'm in an airline deal, an airline pilot. Supposed to be able to drink and play party hard. But eventually, I did pull away from the crowd. It just took a while. I said to the doctor, I knew you would tell me that, but I said, please let me go home and just let Barbara hang on to me, let my mind uncoil. Let me absorb what's happened. He said, you need to get in treatment tonight. I took a breath and said, okay. So we drove across town down to Anchor Hospital off of Yorktown Road down there. I was just down there the other day, Talbot. And it went into the treatment center of the clothes on my back. Now the last, as we made the, following this directions, this place that I'd never heard of, made that final turn down there, and there was a sign there. It's not there now, but it was at the time, and the headlights hit it. I was very close to it as I made the turn there. It said Anchor Hospital, Hospital for Alcoholism and Other Chemical Dependencies. And I hit the brake, the lights right on that sign. And it's just like a lot of the things that we do when we write things down or we see them written down, and it has an impact, and I felt like somebody just kicked me right in the stomach. And I'm looking at that sign thinking, my God, how in God's name did I end up here? A treatment center for alcoholics, and this is where my life comes to an end. How did this happen? And I sat there for just a few moments, and I had this little flashback of all the really high points in my life, and the accomplishments and the achievements and the things that I was just mega proud of that I thought really defined me. And all of a sudden they were gone. I wasn't sure if they'd ever really existed. And I remember sitting there completely deflated, feeling zero self-worth, zero value as a human being. I just had no value. Later, some years later, I read a summarizing paragraph one of the doctors wrote, and he said, given the history and background of this man, it was unlikely to believe he would ever be a productive member of society, and I had come far and done a lot. I thought when I read that summary, I thought, God, that's pretty doggone dismal. And I thought, well, I was the one that gave him all the information, so. We started down the hill into the treatment center. Had no idea what to expect. And for the first time that day, it occurred to me, this is March the 9th. This is my 27th wedding anniversary. And I said in a very defeated way, hell of a way to spend an anniversary, huh? I then heard the second comment that I could not fathom that day, and Barbara very softly said, might be the best one we ever had. And I sat there and I thought, who could think that? Who could form that thought at this moment? My life is gone. And I didn't respond, didn't try to respond. Now let me lighten this up a little bit and tell you that a couple of years ago, March the 9th rolled around, and unexpectedly one of my sponsees came driving up the driveway. I was surprised to see him. It was in the morning. He said, it's March the 9th, I know what day it is, I've heard the story. And he said, I just came by to kind of wish you guys happy anniversary. It was number 45. This was 3 years ago. And so I said, well, come on in. We had some coffee, and I sat down, and we're all laughing and giggling and happy. And he says, well, he says, what's the secret to having stayed married for so long? I didn't get a chance to say anything. Barbara piped up, and she says, you, mostly due to the fact that I could never stand to admit I made a mistake. She knows this is supposed to be an ego-deflating program, and that's her job. And she never takes a day off. So I'm going to stop and kind of come back and try to flesh out a little bit up to this point and tell you that I was born in Wichita, Kansas. That's my hometown. And I was born in September 38, so I'm 72 and a half. I feel like I'm about 36. I don't have any trouble with the number, except it's big and it got here too fast. And I've been blessed with some really good genes. You know, I look around, I go, you know, most of my friends have got knee replacements, hip replacements, back operations, neck operations, other parts that are modified or medicated. And I always get really, really cheery because I say, you know, I still got all my parts and they all work. And again, Barbara, if she was here, jump up and go, yeah, well, most of the time. And I was born in a very, I was raised in a World War II housing project on the southeast edge of Wichita called Plainview. It's supposed to be temporary quarters. It's still there today. It's a very economically depressed area, but I was happy there. I was a happy kid. It was in the 50s. It was literally happy days. You know, we didn't have drugs. We didn't have school shootings. We didn't have gangs out where I was. We didn't have any of these difficulties. Most things that we did was steal some beer and drink beer and get a little bit goofy. And it wasn't, you know, I was happy there. And it was a very diverse community. There were blacks and whites and Hispanics. There was a small Native American segment that I was part of. And I was very active in that. I grew up in the songs and the powwows and the dances. I was a dancer when I was young, and I'm an ethnic mix of several things, and I think two of them are rather benign when it comes to when I start drinking. The other two cause a big problem. They always go to the bar with me, and that's the Irish part and the Comanche part. And so I'm usually going to have a non-routine drinking evening. There'll be some excitement of some sort before it's over with. And I thought it was a good combo because I liked the I love the Irish music. That part of it I really liked. I had the albums and I knew the songs and all the various groups. And gotta love those rebel songs and freedom songs and drinking songs. And I knew where those places were when I was flying around the country, and I'd head for them. I knew how long it took me to change clothes, and I knew where they were, and I got there quick. And I loved to sit there with those real, legitimate, authentic Irish bands and sing along, and Wild Colonial Boy and the Girl in the Black Velvet Band. And oh man, I just love that stuff. And I'd literally be the last one out the bar that night when they closed up and left. And so it was a lot of fun. Then there had it would be another time, another place, another mood. And I'd think, you know, I think I'll just have a couple of drinks and go out and kill some white people. And bad news if that hits in Billings, Montana, where all those cowboy bars are. That's bad timing. When I was 14, my parents, the alcoholism had really ripped the family by that time. And my parents got their first divorce, and that really hit me hard. I did not see that coming. I was fortunate because I'm not a guy that came from a family that experienced a lot of domestic violence. I never saw my dad beat my mom. There wasn't a lot of screaming and yelling, not a lot of fighting. But there was that one thing that all alcoholics' homes have, and that is that constant sense of uncertainty, that palpable current of chaos that is there. I just never knew what was getting ready to happen or who was going to be drunk when I got home. I could not bring friends home because of the embarrassment, the things that would go on. And I just never knew quite what was going to happen. And my sister is 2 years younger than I am. She experienced a lot worse than I did later on. But by the time I was 17 and graduating from high school, each of my parents had been married and divorced two more times. So I'd gone through four sets of step-parents and step-siblings. I don't like them. I think I had two basic reactions and emotions when I was a kid. I was either laughing or I was really angry. And I didn't like step-parents, and I didn't like the siblings. And I wouldn't know any of them if they were in the room tonight. I don't remember any of them specifically. And so I'd get in some trouble, and they would suggest that maybe I should go over and live with the other family, and I would do that for a little while, and then something would happen over there. I'd go back over here. Faces and names would change, and this is kind of how I traversed through high school. And I was a good student when I applied myself, but nobody cared. I was all alone. Nobody paid any attention. And so I screwed away a lot of opportunity that I could have had in high school for academic work. I was an athlete. I thought I was pretty good. I was probably average at best. And so I made my way through high school, wasn't drinking a whole lot, I looked too young. I was always the one in the group that got carded and we'd all have to leave, so I wasn't doing a whole lot of that at the time. Didn't have a lot of fascination for that. And I graduated, and most of my buddies married their young high school sweethearts, went to work for Boeing, Beech, Cessna, or some of the other aircraft factory plants that Wichita's known for. And I wasn't interested in doing that, didn't have a girlfriend, I was going to join service. And one of my buddies came back from the Marine Corps, and I was really impressed. He was right out of Marine boot camp. And he and I spent 3 or 4 hours in a bar one afternoon as he regaled me with these really massively cruel, sadistic stories of what Marine drill instructors do to their recruits in boot camp. And it was probably an early indication of really flawed thinking because I just hung on every word and I thought, God, I just can't wait to go do that. So I was 18. I found a recruiter within a day or two, signed on the line, and off I went. And here's why I'm going to tell you I never found a place that I didn't belong, because I did find a place where I belonged. Once I snapped into the routine in boot camp, I liked it. It was tough, it was structured, it was extraordinarily intense, severe, competitive, and they had something I had never experienced before in my life, that sense of camaraderie and esprit de corps that the Marine Corps is known for. I had never experienced that before, and I still have it today. I still have it today with my Marine buddies, my ex-Marine buddies, former Marine buddies. You know, once a Marine, always a Marine. Only branch of service I know that does that. And I snapped into it, and I excelled. I wasn't trying to. I just wanted to finish. I just didn't want to get washed out. I didn't want to get set back. And so as we completed the 13 weeks, there were 70 of us roughly, and the drill instructor called off three names, and mine was the second name called. Three top guys in the platoon. Completely unexpected. Took me by surprise. And I was amazed by that. And I was so remarkably, extraordinarily proud of that. And I got one stripe on my sleeve. One stripe. Private first class. And I'll tell you, I couldn't take my eyes off of it. I kept looking down that red-bordered private first class prowess. You know, and of course in the Marine Corps, that was heavy rank based on my peers. They were slick sleeves. They were privates. And so we went to Camp Pendleton. And it was raining one night. We all had guard duty. Due to my heavy rank, I'm inside a Quonset out of the rain. And I'm acting corporal of the guard. My buddies are outside in the rain walking post. And I looked over in the corner, and there was a first lieutenant's uniform. I saw the silver bar. And I kicked back, and I thought, by God, you know, at the rate I'm going, general can't be too far away. And and so my intention was to stay. I love being a Marine. That's what I was going to do. 4.5 years later, I came in as a young enlisted guy, and my commanding officer took me into the office, and he said, there's a new program out called Marine Aviation Cadet. It's just starting up. And he said, you're the only guy in the entire unit who has entry scores that will qualify you to go test for that. I knew I had some high scores. I was surprised by it. I don't know how they got there, but they were there. And I always wanted to fly, but that was not realistic for me because, in my view, people who got to be pilots came from Eastboro, the big ritzy section of Wichita. They came from the other areas of Wichita, and they were college people. Their families were not alcoholics. They didn't come from the Native American segment in this little World War II ghetto over here. Their families had prestige and status. They were somebody. And so they could get through the doors. And now he's telling me that I've got a chance if I want to go after it. So I went over and I tested. It was an all-day affair. I came back and I passed. He said to me, he said, that's great, but he said there are about half the people are not going to make it through this program. It's an 18-month, extraordinarily intense program. And he said, you're going to be one of the only ones coming in the back door because you're enlisted status and testing out like this. 98-99% of these people coming in here are going to come in from the civilian side. They require 2 years college minimum to get through the door, and most of them will have more than that, and this will be a fast race. And that gave me a little pause for thought because I knew that I was on the high probability end of not making it because I was starting off with a big, big educational deficit. And I was going to be in a fast race with a fast crowd. But I wanted to fly, and I said, okay. I went home to Wichita. The day before I was going to go to Pensacola, they had a powwow. I went out and danced. We have what they call a special, and my Kiowa family asked for that. I went out. All my friends from the community came out and tailed it, shook my hand, tailed in behind me. We went around the arena because it was a farewell honoring dance because I was leaving the next day for Pensacola. That dance impacted the heck out of me. And I drove down there and I thought, I cannot come back as a failure. I cannot come back to this community with my head down and tell them I didn't make it because I'm the only one that's got the opportunity. And so that drove me through 18 months in four phases of flight training. Through all four phases of flight training, I was always number two guy. First time I was convinced it was administrative error. Somebody jumbled some papers and got the wrong names from someplace, and I was just going to chill out and be okay with it. And then as this progressed through the 18 months, I was never convinced that I was as good as grades indicated. I never really believed it. And I was watching my friends wash out every week, sometimes daily. I don't think one of them ever came to say goodbye to me. They looked me in the eye. Sea bag over the shoulder, their head down, their eyes averted. It was over for them. They'd never fly, and I'd never see them again. And I thought, one of these days, that'll be me with the sea bag over my shoulder. And I just soldiered on. I just went on. And I pushed hard. The final 6 months, I left Florida and went to Texas for advanced jet flight training. Now I'm drinking. I'm drinking really hard. I got to tell you that I do not remember ever drinking without getting drunk. Now I know that's not true. That can't be true, or I'd be dead. But my memory is, I don't drink without getting drunk. And I'm drinking big time in this cadet program. Friday nights and Saturday nights, we are going wild. Big Book talks about some of this, and I could still manage my drinking because I had something that was more important than the alcohol at that point in time. And so I cut it off after Saturday night. This is before Vietnam. Sunday, I was studying, I was gearing up for Monday because, by God, this dream was not going to get away from me. And I loved my drinking, but it didn't override my dream. I got into Beeville, Texas on a Friday night, hooked up with a bunch of my friends. We went to the officers' club, got drunk, and they said, let's go into town to this little place called Kane's Drive-In. So that's where all the good-looking girls hang out, and they think we're pretty slick because we represent good marrying potential. So I said, okay. So I went in with them. I was never very gutsy with the girls, but I went in, had a lot to drink, and they immediately went after a carload of girls and noticed they were talking. The driver wasn't talking to anybody. And I thought, oh, I better have a few more drinks. And so, I don't know about you, but booze does wondrous things for me. And so I'm standing back there drinking, rehearsing some things to say to her that I thought were just so, so, so cool. And I strode up there to the where she was sitting, and I thought, you know, I won't be surprised. She'll probably just take her clothes off right now. And I walked up there, and she turned and looked at me, and she looked at me. I forgot absolutely everything I was going to say. I'm standing there completely vacant and flat-footed, and she's got this look of expectation on her mind, on her face. I walked up there, she'd say something, and I looked at her, and she had really had gorgeous brown eyes. Then I said, you have the most beautiful brown eyes I've ever seen, except it's late in the evening, and I think it came out like, hey, you got this brown eyes. And she gave me this look like I had just stood there and peed on the side of her car. And I was so embarrassed, I turned around and left. You know, now I've been drunk a lot of times, and I know there have been a lot of times I've been drunk, couldn't talk. But there have been freshest few times when I was so drunk I couldn't talk, and I knew I couldn't talk. And that was one of them. And I think there's some kind of special curse that God throws down there when you're that drunk and you're still capable of being embarrassed. And I was. And I left, and I thought, that's it for me. I'm not going back. And a little while later, she got out to go into the restroom, and I happened to be standing where I could see her, and I got a good look at her. And I watched her go in there, and I thought, man, alive, turquoise shorts. She's got a really cute butt and nice legs. And brown eyes, way more than I had on my list. And I thought, you know, I had an A thought, actually, and I didn't know it. I didn't recognize it for about 29 more years. But I watched her go in there, and I thought, God Almighty, I want what she has, and I'm willing to go to any length to get it. And I did. I did. I had a chance encounter with her and her girlfriend the next day. I had a cadet buddy with me, and I walked in. I was scared. I was nervous, but I was sober. They let us buy him some coffee. She gave me her name. We started a date on February the 25th of 1963, which was her 20th birthday. She pinned a set of gold wings on my right over my heart, two gold bars on my shoulders. I'll tell you, that was a dream that was so big I didn't think it could be contained. I am now a commissioned Marine Corps officer, and I'm a jet fighter pilot, and I got a good-looking girl. We went home to Wichita for 3 weeks, and she stayed with my sister, and I stayed with my dad, who was really spiraling down bad. And as the leave was coming to an end, I called her, and I said, this is coming to an end. Let's run down to Oklahoma and get married. They had no waiting period down there. So we drove down to Newkirk, Oklahoma, and Buddy and his wife from my high school days went down with us, took their rings off, loaned us the rings, and we got married in front of a justice of peace. They got divorced. We're still married. She joined me out in California. She was the youngest wife in the squadron at age 20. She was instantly pregnant, which should come as no surprise. And we had a little boy, and 8 days, less than a year later, we had a second one. I used to get so tired and ticked off of people coming up and going, you guys Catholic? It used to irritate the hell out of me, and I'd go, no, we're just horny Protestants. And we don't. Oh, and I'd think, why do they think only Catholics can do this? And I left her with those two little babies and I went to Vietnam. We were one of the first Marine jet squadrons in Vietnam. Now, I'm drinking a lot. I'm hitting happy hour, and I am the last one out there. If I'm not night flying on Friday afternoons, I'm at a happy hour for the duration. And I'm having a good time. Nobody had to encourage me to drink, and I'm doing it really well. And I had some colorful episodes out there. You know, colorful is okay. You know, as long as you're colorful, that's something to really be proud of. And guys would say to me, God, you were colorful last night. And I didn't remember it, but it was okay. and things were happening. You know, I got into treatment. I started looking back. And I thought this. I was on track a long time ago. I just didn't know it. I just didn't know it. I went to Vietnam. We were 50 miles south of Da Nang, a little place called Chu Lai. Primitive place. Marines in foxholes securing the perimeter around this little airstrip. We lived in sand, hot sand, no air conditioning, no Air Force luxury stuff. We lived in tents, 110, 120 degrees there sometimes. Couldn't get any ice, no ice cube, no cold drinks. Eating sea rations out of cans, and we had a little portable landing strip that was half of what we needed, but we were all carrier qualified, so all of our flying was into arresting gear and jet assist takeoffs. The flying was challenging, and we did a damn fine job. I was with 28 of the finest pilots I will ever be blessed and honored to be with, and I got to be with those guys. I picked up some decorations over there. I applied for a regular commission, which would guarantee me a Marine Corps career. And I thought I had a reserve commission, as most of us did. And I thought there's no way they'll ever award a regular commission to an officer who has a high school education. That usually required a college degree. And I'll be doggone, I got a regular commission. See, this is what I'm supposed to do. These are the things that I'm expected to do. I'm not expected to go into a place in Fargo, North Dakota, and bring down the house of disgrace. That's not what I'm supposed to do. Came back from Vietnam. I stayed in for 2.5 more years as a flight instructor in Advanced Jet Flight Training Command and decided to get out. Barbara wasn't pushing for it, but I was looking now, and I thought, I'm going to be away from my family for 4 to 6 years if I finish this career. And I wanted to stay until I couldn't fly or I died. But I had to make a choice. So I made a choice and I resigned. Because I told Barbara, we're going to have a good family. We're not going to have one that's splintered, and we're not going to have one like I grew up in. So I got out, and for nearly, and 3 weeks later, I was in class at Northwest Airlines. And for nearly 22 years at Northwest, I had the same kind of a career. Because I loved the job, I loved the people, I loved the flying. I couldn't wait to go to work. It was fun, and I just couldn't get enough of it. I'm partying hard, but we're all partying hard. And it's okay, you know. I mean, prosecutor used to think that this was the only crew that ever did this, and of course I couldn't say, you kidding, we do this all the time. You know, there was I couldn't say a word, nor should I have. Barbara and I had talked about adopting a little child before we ever got married. We had the two boys, and she wanted a daughter. I said, okay, let's adopt, let's do it, and quit talking about it. So we had a heck of a fight because we had the two boys, and we put up a really tenacious 14-month struggle, and we got this beautiful little Indian girl, and she came to our house when she was 17 days old. Now we had the perfect family. Barbara had her daughter, but I instantly found out what daughters do to their dads because she became the center of my universe. She was the sunshine in my life. She could not walk past me without me telling her, Dawn, come over here. And I'd pick her up and look in that little face. God, she was beautiful. I'd say, thank you for being my girl. She'd say, thanks for being my dad. Perfect family, perfect career, perfect neighborhood, perfect everything. Drinking was escalating and progressive. I wasn't aware of it. And when she was 17, I'd passed up being a captain for 2 years because I wanted to be home. I didn't want to be a junior captain and be gone. I wanted to be home with my girl. I thought when she graduates, she's going to go to college, I thought. And so as that time approached, I put in a card and I went to Chicago to take a special test to become a captain. That afternoon, she and some of her friends, when Barbara took me to the airport, went over there and took what they wanted, and she ran away. Don't know if I'd have seen that coming if I hadn't been drinking. I don't deny it. I just simply don't know. Barbara found the note late that night and couldn't call me. I called home the next day and discovered that this had happened. I panicked, telling her where to go and who to call and where to look. God, my little girl was gone. I was scared to death. I got on the airplane in Chicago. I was home in 2 hours. Somewhere on that flight, in a way I'll never understand, nor am I aware of it occurring, something happened to me. And I got off the airplane and I hated her. I hated her worse than I thought I had the capacity to hate anyone or anything. And I told Barbara, I said, I don't care if she dies in the streets. She'll never come back to my home. Nor will I have her name ever mentioned again in my presence as long as I'm alive. And I made sure the family knew this. Within 2 days, anything she'd ever owned or touched in the house was gone. There was no evidence she'd ever been there. I went to an attorney and gave him $500 and disowned her. I went to the bank and ripped up her adoption papers. I tried to annul the adoption and I couldn't. And in the midst of this boiling cauldron of hatred in ways that only a benevolent alcoholic can do, I thought, you know, my wife isn't handling this too well. She probably needs a therapist. So I looked in the phone book. Luck of the draw, I pulled out a PhD's name, and I got a good one. Luck of the draw. We saw him twice a month for 2 years. By the time it was over, he knew about as much about me as anybody except Barbara. I didn't like talking about my daughter. Interestingly, the subject of drinking never came up during any of that time. Alcohol never came up. And I'll tell you, you know, it wouldn't have bothered me if he had. I had no trouble talking about it. I wasn't trying to steer anything away. You want to talk to me about my drinking? Sure, I'll talk to you about it. I got no problem with it. It just never came up. He said something to me one time about my daughter, and I looked at him, and a statement flew out of my mouth that I'd never, ever consciously formed. Don't remember having this thought before, but it came out and it absolutely portrayed who I was and what I was and how I did things. Because I looked at him, I said, I'm going to tell you something, doctor. I said, I would rather hate than hurt. And that's what I did. He said, you survived a childhood doing that, and if you continue, it'll destroy you. Everything he told us was true. Some things just took a little longer to prove out. I didn't respond to him. But I'll tell you what I was thinking. And he probably knew it. I was thinking, you may be a PhD family therapist, but I'm an airline captain and I'll do it my way. And that's exactly what I was thinking. That's what happened. As I look back on it, I thought I got angry. No one would hurt me if I got angry enough. That wall came up and pain can't penetrate it because I'm too angry. And I'm not vulnerable to the pain. And that same wall that comes up that keeps the pain out keeps me in. And it became a cancer. I went into, that's where we were. The other thing was the alcohol quit working. Barbara said, I don't want you drinking at home because you say things about Don. And I knew I did. So I'd go to a hotel room and I'd lock myself in. I knew where every liquor store in the system was, how long it took to get there, which ones closed at 8, which ones closed at 9, which ones were open on Sunday. I knew everything. I knew exactly how long it took me. And I'd come back, close the door, lock it, turn the TV on so there was noise in the room. I wouldn't answer the phone if a crew member called. I wouldn't go to the door if they knocked on the door. All I wanted to do is drink. I go through a quart of booze pretty fast. The first drink goes down a little hard because I mix them stiff. And sometimes I got to choke it down a little bit. And after that, they slide down. And I remember the warmth and the feeling. Before the second hand goes around on that first drink, I feel it. I can still remember it. The warmth and the just spreading through my system. Everything's okay. I'm loosening up in there. Nothing really is a big deal anymore. I can handle it. Who cares? It's okay. And I never got that, ever. From that point on, I never got that. Yeah, I might as well have been pouring gas on the fire, because when I drank at that point on, here come the hatred, the self-pity, the martyrdom. Look at all the things I had done for her. Look how she repaid me. Look what she did to me. That doctor told me when he said this about the childhood, he says, that worked for you, but he says, now your daughter's done that. And he says, she's the person you love more than anything. He said, it's going to take an awful lot of work to do that, and I thought, I'll do the work. And I did. And so by the time this arrest came through, I was exhausted from all of this. I tried it over and over and over, and I never got what I was after with the alcohol. It just didn't work for me anymore. That's where we were when this arrest took place. I walked into this treatment center. I didn't want anybody to know who I was, what I was. It was a week before anybody saw the color of my eyes because my head was down. Within a day or two, the media had it. Now they knew. Everybody knew. Everybody knew who I was and what I was. Hospital had 2 TV sets. I wouldn't go near either one of them. I couldn't. I just get sick. I was the lead story every news segment that came on. I was the lead story. But you know, we always have little patient folks whose designated duty is to come report. And so they would come report and tell me. So I wasn't missing anything. A week to the day that I went into treatment, they announced that I had been terminated from Northwest Airlines, and I should have been, that the FAA had taken all my flight certificates, and they should have an emergency revocation that they rarely did at the time. I'd lost my FAA medical because of my alcoholism, and that was fair too. I'm a hardcore believer in acceptance of personal responsibility and being accountable. I believe strongly that when you do what you did, you get what you got. Sadly, the tragic outcome and outfall of this disease is that the consequences don't belong to just me alone. My family gets to share in those. Everybody who loves me or cares anything about me gets to suffer as a result of the things I do. I take it to everybody. In the first week of treatment, I walked into a group therapy room, and they closed the door. There were 8 or 10 of us. I didn't intend to talk, didn't intend not to talk, but for some reason I began to talk about my daughter. And for the first time, that wall of anger was not there, and I broke down and cried. I hadn't cried at my parents' funerals. I just didn't cry. I cried. I sat in there and I sobbed because my heart was broken. And I took the pain finally straight on like I'm supposed to do, like all of us are supposed to do. I felt it. And then they did what they always did. You know, they hugged me, and but I still felt so embarrassed. I felt like I was naked, no clothes on, and I should never, you know. But it was one of the most massive moments I had in treatment. And I learned that for me to cry has nothing to do with how tough I am or how tough I'm not. I began to get the feelings back that God had given me long ago and I had so buried. And I got a hold of Barbara and I said, fine, Don, let's put the family back together again. Treatment center had no phone calls, no visiting privileges. They said, that is such an awesome breakthrough for you. We'll give you a day room if you can make it happen. A few days later, I walked into the day room. The two doctors heard about it and they said, could we please come watch? I walked into a day room. They were off to the side. I saw them by the wall. I looked over. First time I'd seen my girl in 2 years, and I thought I didn't remember that she was that small. My two sons were there. I walked over and I put my arms around her for the first time in 2 years. I hugged her and kissed her and told her how much I loved her instead of how much I hated her. And I looked down and in her arms was a 5-month-old granddaughter who took my heart as quickly as my daughter originally had. My daughter got married and I didn't even know her last name. First week of treatment, the promises are already starting to come true in the midst of this calamity, this disaster. All the bad stuff was still unfolding, and it was bad, bad, bad. Now they come to me and they start telling me about legal consequences that none of the attorneys thought about or knew about on the day of the arrest. And every 2 to 3 days, they're taking me out to give me the latest bad news, and the consequences are doubling, penalties are doubling. And every time they do it, it's like somebody sucked the air out of the room and I can't breathe. And I spend the next couple of days just trying to do this thing called acceptance and get my heartbeat back to normal, and then they do it again. This went on 6 times. The final time I stepped outside and there was a doctor. And he said, you got to come down to my office. And I knew this was bad. I went down there, my counselor's there, and he said, sit down. He said, the federal grand jury has just indicted you. You're now looking at 15 years in federal prison, a $250,000 fine, and an attorney's coming in Sunday wants $50,000. I went broke in the first 30 days, didn't have the money. I said, I can't afford it, can't do it. He said, I have to ask you if you're going to hurt yourself. And I said, no. I went back to my room and collapsed. I don't remember falling, but I remember lying with my head next to the carpet, and I was crying again. I said, God, I can't do this anymore. I can't do it even one more time. Please, I have nothing left. I can't even do it one more time. Please help me. And I slept that night. I had many, many, many experiences in treatment, all of them life-changing. But you see, I went in there with nothing else to bet on. I didn't know about this 12-step stuff. I didn't know about this AA stuff. I didn't know about the big book. But I read it many times in the 12 and 12 because I was never in the rec room where the TV was. All my patients, I was in my room reading, studying, and doing exercises that none of them ever did in that massive workbook that we had because I was not going to be out there with the TV. I dedicated myself to my treatment and my recovery. I think I worked as hard in there as I had to get my wings because my life depended on it, and I hope to God there was something to this deal. I got out of treatment. I was immediately in a very heavily publicized 3-week trial in the Twin Cities. Never thought I'd be the one to see my picture sketched on the 6 o'clock news, and there it was. I never thought I'd be locked up unless I was a POW in Vietnam. And now I'm going to jail or prison. This is a for sure certain thing. Had in a story with an attorney that I don't have time to go into. It's a beautiful story. Amazing story with this man. I told him I wanted to plead guilty. He said, with the media attention, that's a bad move. He says, when you plead guilty, you're not saying I didn't do it. You're just saying you must prove the charges that you brought against the constitutional right. I said, okay. I said, I'll be convicted. I know that. And so when the jury came back very quickly, and I was the captain, so I was always first one up. He said, guilty. And I saw him stiffen. I reached over and patted him. I said, it's okay, Peter. It's all right. It's okay. We went back for the sentencing. Just a few months later, this was very quick. I mean, I was arrested in March. The trial was over in August, and I was in prison in December. There was none of this stuff about drawing it out for 3 or 4 years, nor did I wish to do that. I didn't want to do that. Went back for the sentencing. There were sentencing guidelines in play, 12 months minimum, 18 months maximum. I knew I was going to get 18 months. I was a captain. I had made some level of peace with that. A day and a half before sentencing, walked into my attorney's office. He said, I got bad news. I sensed it. He said, the judge has just announced to the media and to the other two attorneys that he's going to depart upward from the sentencing guidelines. He can go all the way to 15 years. This judge had very strong feelings about this case, and I saw him every day for 3 weeks. I recognized him. I saw him. I read him. And he was entitled to it. This is a horrific betrayal of the public trust. He was entitled to feel that way. But the prosecutor hadn't asked for this. This was something he wanted to do. I knew it was going to be big. I was in treatment with a federal judge. He said, I got to tell you a lot about the system. And one of the things he talked about was the sentencing. He said, that's a charade. He said, you'll talk, your attorney will talk, maybe you'll have witnesses. But he said, that is a charade. He said, when we come through the door, the sentence is set. We never change it from the bench. Judges and attorneys and prosecutors around the country have corroborated that and told me that's true. You know, he said, that's just part of the deal. So you need to know that. I knew it. The other two guys didn't. So he's telling everybody, including the media, it's going to be a big sentence. And I knew that. I was so scared as I stood up, I didn't know how I was going to say. Just please let me say something from the heart. I talked about being grateful for my sobriety, for the good things that happened inside my family, and that I accepted responsibility from this for day one. I couldn't change anything that happened from yesterday, much less what had happened a few months before. And one of the miracles of the story, he announced a sentence from the bench on me of 16 months, 2 months less under the guidelines, blew everyone away. I certainly didn't expect it, nor did my attorney. A few years later, and I thought I'll never know why he did that, a few years later, he told my attorney in chambers, I was going to sentence him to 4 years that morning. And he said, I looked down and I thought about him. I thought about his service in Vietnam, what he said, and about him as a human being. And I came down from the bench. It never happens. It happened that day. He did something else. He said, this is a very complex case. He said, this is tried under a law that was not designed for aviation professionals. There will be appeals. I'll let you three stay, remain free until your appeals are exhausted. The other two said, okay. I said, no, I'll go to jail now. I've been convicted. I'm going. Everything that took place in this story, a lot of I's and me's in here, is always about we. It was about what I learned in treatment. It was about how I used the steps. It was about the principles, concepts, and the ideas, and the power of this entire process. That's what this story is about. And that's what I did, and that's what I used, because they were my tools. I said, I will go to jail. I will go to prison now. He told my attorney later, he said, no defendant before or since has ever done that. He said, for a moment, he said, I was lost for words. I told my attorney, I said, well, he wasn't lost very long. On December the 5th of 1990, 34 years to the day that I walked into Marine boot camp, I walked into the Atlanta Federal Prison System as inmate 04478-041. Spent 424 days in the prison system. I never talk about it from the podium. Had a lot of things happen, a lot of experiences. I think I handled them well. I never talk about it from the podium. Audiences love those stories, but it hadn't got anything to do with my recovery. But my recovery has everything to do with how I handle prison, the people in it, and the situations and circumstances. I came out. Yeah, I had a guy come up to me one time. I said, 424 days. And he said, man, he said, that ain't nothing. He said, I was out there 18 years. I looked at him and smiled. I said, I guess you win. That was a long time for me, I'll tell you that. That was a long time for me. I came out, I was broke, I was the most notorious pariah in all of aviation. The judge, I forgot to tell you, put sanctions on me, heavy duty, bad sanctions, and made sure that I never, ever, ever, ever flew again on top of everything the FAA had done. A year after I got out of prison, and another story I don't have to go into, but it's a beautiful story that contains a miracle, he lifted those sanctions. No one thought that was possible. However, that just took one of the S's out of the word impossible. The FAA said, you want to fly again, you start right from the bottom with a private license. None of my pilot buddies thought it was possible to get back in the cockpit at this stage of the game and start from the ground up. And for a brief moment, I didn't think it was possible either. And I told Barbara, I said, how do I stay sober? One day at a time. How do I get the licenses back? One license at a time. Change my attitude. Look forward to this. Go back and relearn the things that I learned in 1961. Change my attitude, everything changes. 10.5 months later, I had 4 licenses passed, written exams passed. No shortcuts, no easy fixes, just hard work. But there's a flying part that has to be done, and I couldn't do it. I was working at Anchor Hospital, making $14,000 a year in the treatment center, the counseling department. Gonna cost 10 to 20 grand to do this. That was a deal breaker. I was done. One of my buddies gets a hold of me and he says, "You didn't know it, but I got a flight school. I want you to come up here and live with me and my family, go through the flight school free." I went up there, had 13 conditions of probation. So I checked into the Minnesota Department of Corrections. I spent 44 days living with that man and his family. Rained out 14 days, and I just never slowed down. I continued to study. The 30 days that I could fly, I flew 78 hours. I got 4 licenses back. I had 2 of them one morning by 11:15, and I don't think that had ever been done before. Had wonderful experiences up there. I'm going to AA meetings up there. I'm participating. I'm heavily involved in my recovery. Always have been. I came back. I thought, that's great, but nobody's going to hire me. Everybody knows about Lyle Prowse and the Northwest Flight 650 thing. My only chance to fly again is if I find a place in Africa that never had any TV. Maybe fly some goats and cattle around. The licenses physically arrived at my home a month later, and within an hour of their arrival, I got a phone call from the head of the pilot union at Northwest. A grievance had been automatically filed because of the termination. I never activated it. I said they were fair in firing me. They were justified to do what they did. They didn't fire me for being an alcoholic. They fired me for what I did, and it was fair. This pilot says to me, he said, "This is the best phone call I've ever made," because he said, 3 hours ago, John Dasburg, the president and CEO of Northwest Airlines, made a personal decision to bring you back to Northwest Airlines and put you back to full flight status. I sat there. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. My tears just flowed down my cheeks. I didn't even attempt to stop that. I thought, that is a level of courage that is so far beyond the word extraordinary, I will never understand it. 50,000 people, why would he care about me? And what happened if I relapsed? He put his career on the line, that I wouldn't relapse or have a flying incident. Why would he do that? I still don't know, and I've asked him a couple of times. He and I are still in relatively close touch. I went back in November the 1st of 93 and signed a very emotional back-to-work agreement with a lot of people watching, and it was a wonderful, wonderful time. I was never to be a captain again. I said, that's okay. I've been a captain. I couldn't believe I was going to get part of a retirement back. Everywhere I went, I was overwhelmingly welcome back. There's always some who don't want us to get back up. There's always some that think we're damaged goods forever. And then there's always some who'd like to keep our face down in the mud. That's a small percentage in my view. I think the heart and soul of the American social fabric applauds a comeback. They like to see us recover. They like to see us get back up. They like to see us do the things that we do when we get sober. All my experiences were good. I couldn't go on a 12 or 13 day trip without at least 6 or 12 people coming up to me in various places around the country and the world saying, "I'm glad you're back," and introducing themselves to me. Northwest now had a program because they'd taken such a beating, and I was part of the program, watching pilots recover and come back and get a chance to save their lives and their careers and their families and all of the good things that happened. I dedicated myself to being the best employee on the property. By the time I finished this up, I didn't have quite 5 years left. I wanted no one who had ever dared risk anything by believing in me to ever have an ounce of regret. Never. And so I worked hard to that end, and I think I did a good job. The miracles just keep happening. I was happy where I was. I would like to have ended up in the left seat, but I was never, ever going to ask for that. And as I came up on my final year at Northwest, I got a phone call. I was speaking at United Airlines. Same pilot said, "Guess what? John Dasburg knows you're coming up on your last year. He thinks you need to be a 747 captain." I went back and I checked out. I spent the last year in the left seat of a 747 mega-million-dollar airplane, crew of 18, flying 400 passengers all over the United States, all over the world. Trusted, not because I'm Lyle Prowse, but because I am a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they know it, and they trusted me. I finished the career in September of 98 at the then mandatory retirement age of 60. Within several days of retiring, I get a phone call from my attorney. He said, "I just got a call from Judge Rosenbaum, who is now chief judge. He's the toughest judge in the entire Minnesota Federal District." The judge said to him, he said, "In 16 years on the federal bench, I've never supported a petition for pardon, which I had never even considered." He said, "Tell Lyle, if he wants to make the attempt, I'll support his." At home, I have a 3-page affidavit that is so chokingly, emotionally powerful, I've never been able to read it all the way through page 3 without getting tears in my eyes. Written by the man who tried me, sentenced me, and sent me to prison. He has become the strongest supporter in my camp. 2 years later, I came walking in, and there were 8 phone messages telling me I just received a presidential pardon. You know, that is a life-changing event. The second day I was in treatment, we went to an outside meeting at Clarkston. My head was down like it always was at that point in time, and I'm listening. They start reading the promises, and I'm listening to the promises. I don't know if you've noticed, but it says if we are painstaking. I'll tell you what that means to me. You're not getting to the promises until you take some pain. I don't know anybody here in this group, in this fellowship, this recovery, who got to see the promises without the price of admission being the pain. And I listened, and then they got to that part that said, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, I thought, no, that does it for me. I'm out of here. That's not going to happen. I'm going to get sober, I think. But I'll never experience these other things. And you haven't heard 70% of the entire story of the miracles. There are many, many more. I want to close, and I want to tell you, I want to do it with something that I heard Father Martin do one time. Now, I'm not stealing from him, because he took it from some girl who sent it to him on a card. I've gotten to go out to Ashley a whole bunch of times. Just came back not long ago. I'm going back again in September. I love that place. I loved him. I thought, I was like a kid around Babe Ruth every time I was around him. I was just in awe of him. And it simply says this, I do not wish you joys without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you faith and strength and love and wisdom and goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also a blessed silence, and God's sweet peace when every day is done. My name is Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic, and I thank you for my sobriety.